A crow picking at eye sockets in a sheep skull was a reminder of how outback country towns were shriveling up. A desert landscape shone red and grey against the Darling River, the dusty desolation of Nyemba country, benevolent colonialism. A town beside a stinking green river of dead fish. The ash-filled streets smelt of bushfire, the air heady with barbecued animals. A town where most of the shops had iron mesh grills, chains and big locks. Auntie June had completed her TAFE course in investigative services. She proudly showed the Certificate 3 in a nice frame on the wall. It had taken 30 hours online. Her office was in the main street. It used to be Vince's Video Rentals, and people still dropped overdue items down the hatch. The latest had been Midnight Cowboy. She cleaned the window with a Wettex and swept the footpath out front. The handwritten sign stuck on the window announced, Yanakiri Investigation Services, confidentiality guaranteed. The name meant to run fast, as most people she chased were doing that. There were no clients except occasional Murray women wanting June to track cheating husbands or men who had run off to escape child support payments. The women didn't pay much, nothing in fact, except the occasional kangaroo leg still covered in grey fur. To illustrate her thoughts, when June opened the fridge just now to get some milk, blood dripped onto the lino floor. She locked the office door and stepped outside to take in some hot air. Many other businesses stood empty along the road, most with for sale signs. The failing economy had gutted the biggest hotel. It sat there now with blackened windows, graffiti and glassless doors. Next door to June's office sat the original Commonwealth Bank, a majestic sandstone building displaying a fly-blown notice on the door. This bank has been closed to improve customer service. The local Gunji, Police Sergeant Bruce Blackett, pulled up outside June's office in his wagon and sneered. He was in his 60s with a paunch and thinning grey hair over skin cancers. His black R.M. Williams riding boots were non-uniform issue, convenient for kicking someone. Blackett admired himself in the rearview mirror and picked his teeth with a match. June stuck out her chin and oozed annoyance while the copper looked over her broad golden face, pink lips, tall frame and skinny legs. She knew she was a healthy-looking 50-year-old beauty with white teeth, a freshwater Gamoray Aboriginal woman born of the clay plains, dust and kangaroos. Blackett pointed at the office sign and hooted. He hung his arm out the window and slapped the driver's door. He sounded very amused. Investigated any major crimes lately, like a murder or a diamond heist, or just some Murray kid pinching a packet of Arnott's custard creams? Said Blackett. Cert 3 in investigative services. Jesus wept. June held up a middle finger. He drove off laughing. Later in the day, June watched Cousin Tomo drive past her white fibro house in a back street of Wilga. She dug a hole with a sharp spade in the front garden of limp geraniums. She was aiming to go to the Survival Day concert on the reserve. The town council was putting on a sausage sizzle in the main street to mark Australia Day and 1788, the invasion by English colonisers. Some townies dressed up in colonial dresses and danced the polka in the main road, sticking it to the blacks all over again. Tomo, the Murray activist, turned the corner in his beaten-up Toyota. June beckoned and he looked unsure, but he parked on the verge and walked over. His dreadlocks hung around his ears and his marijuana-leafed earrings swung in the sun. She loved him like a son. He looked tired and edgy as they leant together. I'm coming with you, cuz, she whispered. Too dangerous, aunt. He stared at her feet. You stay home. Let us young fellas take risks. I got a call from that Steve Alunga working for the Aboriginal Legal Service in the city. He wrote some articles for Indigenous X about stuff like water consortiums. Corruption up here. The federal government got no water at all from the $80 million it spent. No tender was put out. They just bought it from a fellow who's high up in government. Steve wants to talk to you when he gets here. I just take care of divorces and stuff. June suspected Tomo's Enviro group was planning something illegal. The police arrested him up north a month ago for chaining himself to a trainload of coal. She lay awake at night, terrified that he had mad plans, the kind that got you sent to prison for 20 years as a terrorist. "You're not planning something really stupid, are you?" June grabbed his arm and he flinched, full of nervous energy. She wanted to take his dear head and hug it to her chest to stop him doing something crazy. June had cared for this little cousin down by the river, taught him to swim and read. It was the bond of love that took care of her childlessness and a history of family pain. Tomo had an eager smile. He joined every local environmental protest, fearless fella. Once he'd stayed aloft in a threatened tree, eating baked beans and biscuits, sleeping along a tree limb. He was a bit wild. Women liked him and treated him like a pet. She watched him pace the garden. His long legs and broad shoulders were evidence of her uncle's handsome build, the uncle who disappeared one day when fighting a big mountain fire. Tomo pulled his jacket around his shoulders. It was a Vinnie's second-hand leather jacket with studs rusting on the shoulders. It made him seem tougher than his usual Aboriginal flag T-shirt with "Stop Adani" emblazoned across the back. A terrible uneasiness filled June's head. "I respect you, Aunt," Tomo said, "but you're not getting into trouble because of me. I had a bit of an encounter with a bad fella. I wanted to get explosives for an action. And then an ice dealer tried to force me into selling his drugs. Argued at the pub, but Arthur threw me out. I was real nervous." "Don't do that rubbish." "Yeah, I'm shit scared. A lot of Murray women look up to you. Keep out of it. I'm just meeting a contact." He marked the spot on my map, near the sacred site with the rock paintings. "There's this pile of whitish stones, 50 metres from the track, easy to find." He smoothed the paper scrap and June brushed pie crumbs from the middle and studied it. "I know that place," she said. "Special, eh? Better stay home, Aunt. You got that concert. Tidy up that passenger seat. I don't want a whiff of Yandy on my pants." "No, I'll be okay. Ducky might drop by later. Bake a cake." Tomo walked away with a laugh. She watched him step into the old Toyota. He put his bare foot up on the steering wheel and waved. The place he indicated on his map was sacred, a place which evoked a fourth dimension, where featherfeet spirits from the dreamtime crept around, leaving no marks on the ground. The ochre shelter was a place where ancient spirits spoke to elders. Even old Auntie Mary witnessed their presence and talked with them in language under black, moonless skies. Beings of power traversed the land, creating sites, mountains, waterholes, animals and humans. Old custodians of country remembered ceremony to protect the site. These beings permeated the walls of reality and perception, but June feared for Tomo, who might not recognise their importance and danger. One day, while she camped near that site, a huge water serpent came, Warawai, the Maduka serpent, a being from the night sky of the Milky Way, visited June in a dream, standing up to strike, showing the power of Karapuli. The pointer stars had men fighting the snake with spears. Its yellow eye pierced her own eye in the night, and she woke up in a terrible certainty that the spirits were summoning her, like the unlocking of a gateway with ancient memories behind each one, like Gutti Gutti, who placed one foot on Gundabuka Mountain and one on Mount Granful, this creator splitting a mountain to release a water serpent. It was him. The serpent smelt people with a flickering tongue. Smelt her. June knew about her mother's country around the east of the Darling River. All her people were descended from either Eagle Hawk or Crow, two matrilineal moieties, two groups, Makwara and Kilpara. A few days passed and June had a desperate call from Tomo's wife, Ducky. She hadn't been able to locate him. He was missing. He'd never made it home and his phone didn't answer. June felt a surge of panic. She called the police and told them her cousin was missing, that she knew a location to search and thought something terrible might have happened. She argued and threatened and eventually they agreed to go with her to look for him. Hours after her call, the police followed June and her brother William on foot down the track. She staggered on some gravel, but William held her arm tight. She braced herself. They turned a corner near the rock overhang, but there was nothing, no body, nothing, but a heap of sand, no blood, no evidence, just lots of truck and bike tyres and some curious deep gouges in the earth. June stood dumbfounded. "You're certain this is the right track where he was meeting someone?" said Sergeant Blackett. "Might have been another place." "This is it. Someone's taken him, or worse." "You're the investigator. Thought you'd know the answers already." William scratched his grey beard and stared with contempt at the town police officers. They seemed dubious about June's reporting, as if she was a hysterical female who knew nothing instead of a respected elder. June sighed, sat down on the stones and held her head. It hurt. She had a deep sense that the young man was dead. She was the only one who knew absolutely where he'd been going and why. Shuddering with violent fears and also the realisation that she would have to search for him, alone if necessary. She turned to the men, tired of the superiority of them all, the arrogance of simply having dicks. Blackett picked his teeth with a stick. He stared at her mouth and snapped a photo on his phone. His hand shook. "So you reckon it was a marauding serial killer or something?" He smiled. "You might be next. What was his MO? A shovel, you reckon? What kind? Shifting shovel with a long handle or a little garden spade? Or a pitchfork, like the devil?" She imagined a shovel through Blackett's head. See how he liked it. "You're not stoned on acid or something, June," he said, looking disgusted as he scratched scabs on his hands. "Anyway, no body, no crime. We're going back to the station. He's just pissed off from his missus. Happens every day. You're reading too many crime books. Too caught up in your TAFE course." June couldn't work out why Blackett seemed nervous at this scene, like he was in shock. She spotted a print of a boot in the dirt. She pointed to it, but Blackett shook his head. Soon she overheard him talking to his constable. Blackett clutched his mobile. "How do you delete a dumb text?" he asked. "I'll show you, Sarge," the constable said. "Nah, just tell me. Don't want you reading a private communication." June watched the copper, alert with a sort of fear. The boot print looked fresh, so she snapped a picture with her phone. Strange markings imprinted the earth. The police were tramping over it. She couldn't work it out. Where on earth was the lad? William drove her back to town. Unbroken fields of cotton shone white in the midday sun. That night in bed, June rubbed her cauterized, dark skin with its raised scars and tried to imagine her deep, fluffy possum skin cloak. Oh, alleluia, praise the Lord, as she hid from a long conga line of gungy assholes. What kind of terrible nightmares would she now endure? Her head bulged like a pile of stones waiting for a sacrifice.